Hello, I'm Callum MacLeod, Policy Director for Community Land Scotland. Welcome to this series of conversational podcasts which explore issues around community empowerment and land decisions in Scotland today. In each podcast, two participants will chew over the issues that are most important to them and their communities and offer testimony of their experiences, reflections and perspectives. They come from many different perspectives but share a few elements in common. Firstly, they are from communities based in Scotland's sparsely populated rural areas, where depopulation has been, and often remains, a critical issue. Secondly, they are involved in what we might loosely call community empowerment, and in exploring what that means and what we need to do to enhance that. Thirdly, all the podcasts are about people's experiences of cultures of decision-making. In other words, their experiences of how decisions about the land are made in practice. Community Land Scotland is committed to supporting the community ownership of land and assets to be a significant driver of sustainable development across the whole of Scotland, and to creating a space for testimonies like this to be recorded, heard and learned from. We're delighted to be working with other members of the Community Empowerment and Land Decisions Network to bring you these podcasts. We hope you enjoy this episode.
I'm sitting here with Lincoln and Drula Richford in Wanlock Head, Scotland's highest village, and we're enjoying a cup of coffee, or at least I am. I think there's some tea here. So thank you, Lincoln and Drula, for meeting with me today. We're here to talk about the culture of decision-making regarding the lands. And I'm just wondering, though, before we get into it, what drew you guys to Wanlock Head? Where are you from originally?
Okay, originally from the island of Cyprus, moved to the UK, London, and then many years later, conscious decision to move to Scotland to live after we retired. The reasons for coming to Scotland is that it's a place that we visited often in the previous 40 years, and we like the, well, that there's less people, we like their way of life, and we wanted to go somewhere quieter.
When did you guys move here?
We bought a property in 2006 and yeah. We moved in 2007.
So what, since you've moved here, I'm a relative newcomer, been here around six and a half years, but I've noticed you all have been, and from knowing you over the last few years regarding the land buyout, you all have been involved in various various positions of decision-making since you moved here. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you've been involved in community decision-making and some of your rationale behind that.
I suppose the first thing that happened was that we got involved in the museum. In my case, because Andrilla had started working at the museum as a guide, and then people at the museum asked if I would like to go and be a guide. Mm. It's not something I'd done before, but I said yes, did it, and enjoyed it. Mm. But then I began to see the divisions in the village quite clearly. I'd been going to the pub, and the divisions there were quite clear. And so you got drawn in. I mean, this is a small community, and it's easy to get drawn in, really. Mm. So that started the involvement in the various things that we've been involved in.
So, but between you, you've been on you've been involved with the museum, the village council, the land buyout, the wind farm. There's quite a few things. I mean, I was curious, do you feel like there was a vacuum in terms of people being involved in the community? And if so, why is there a vacuum?
I wouldn't say there was a vacuum, but this is because it's a small place. And, you know, there's a division everywhere. There's in any kind of democracy, there's always division. And even if there isn't, there is.
Well, it's interesting that you're talking about democracy within a village. So it's not, is that so? Is there actually a tradition of democracy here inherited from mining times?
Well, don't forget, this community had gone down to very small numbers. You know, I can't get the precise figure, but it's something around 20 people, right? And so, and these people did go back to the mining. These were the last people from the mining that lived here. People obviously had to move away to get work. So they must have felt very close together. And as soon as anybody else comes in from the outside, it's kind of an invasion.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, since then, the population has grown back up to about 200, bearing in mind it was about 1,000, close to 1,000 when the mining was carried on. So in a small community like this, small numbers of people moving in are going to feel a bit like an invasion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on the other side of it, as you say, is a positive side, because people come here, they're excited by the place. It's an amazing place. It's a lovely place to live. And they want to get involved. And they do get involved. And then they come up against this situation. I mean, if you look at our meeting, our AGM, there were people in that meeting that had come, not because they supported us, because they didn't support us, right? And we have to spend an inordinate amount of time talking to them instead of being able to talk with the people, the majority that want it, and move it forward.
I agree with you. I think, however, what I'm seeing, I think, is a community where there has been certainly a heavy degree of involvement by a few committed individuals, whether it's on the village council or now the community council, but who are now being asked to participate in a land buyout, and land buyouts, you know better than I, are relatively rare in the south of Scotland. And this is a very new way of thinking, I think, for the south of Scotland. And I think that's what we're coming up against in the buyout, is this dynamic where Buccleuch has called the shots for over two centuries, more so. And now we're asking folks to become involved in a way they haven't before. And I think that must be uncomfortable, because they're not talking about the de facto management of the village, you know, potholes, signage. We're asking them to manage to help us manage a landscape of around 4,000 acres. So is that what we're coming up against? Is that this is a real challenge for us, because this is all new.
Now, you're quite right. What we're up against is the fact that this is not the norm here. If we were in the Western Isles, everybody would understand what buyouts do. I mean, in reality, this is the best chance this village has ever had. Really, the potential is massive for the village being able to look after itself and progress in a sustainable manner.
So I guess a question to Andrula as well, both of you, about Sarah and Andrula. Well, then what has made you guys stick it out all these years? whether it's stopping an undesirable wind park, whether it's getting a buyout approved, whether it's managing the ins and outs of the village, which you did, Andrula, on the village council.
Mm-hmm.
What made you guys keep going?
Well, just the really the what made us, what made me keep going, is the fact that when you start something, I like to, you know, it's normal to see it as a natural conclusion, well, to a conclusion, one way or another. You can't just say, oh, yes, I will step up and then step down, you know, soon after. For me, I did enjoy working at the museum, and I learned a lot there.
Mm.
And like Lincoln mentioned, I was very enthusiastic about, you know, the community, old and new, and the history. And that was of interest. The other thing is the first opportunity coming away from a big city in England, having the opportunity to have actually an input in a small community. Plus, from my background, I'm used to living in small communities, and I know, you know, how they work. And you know, the input that people have about what happens in where they live. So, with the village council, I suppose there is a saying that give a busy person something else to do, does it, or something similar. And generally, that's what arises, and there's a history of that, of people, a small group of people being involved in a lot of things, because they say, oh, well, they're a doer, let's just, you know, see if they can do it, kind of thing. That's also part of that. And, but really, is to, if I believe in something, I take part in it, and I want to see it through. And I was passionate about supporting the museum and working there and promoting the history of the village and revising it and stuff. With when the wind farm came along, well, one of the reasons we came here was the beauty and the setting, geographical setting of the village. Mm. So nobody wants to look out of their window and be surrounded by a wind park, as you say. So that was, you think, well, right, so we're not going to, well, the village council called a meeting to inform the population that this is happening, and that we asked the those proposing the wind farm to come and talk to the village. And that was a very good turnout. We had over 80% of the village coming and voting that they did not want it. Now, that maybe answer one of your other questions, is that when chips are down or backs are against the wall, there is this community selective about what they want to either support or object to. And then after that, things fall by the wayside. So anyway, so we, in the village council, as I was at the time, it was that overwhelming decision by vote by the village to oppose the wind farm. We set about, a small group within the village council set about learning and finding out about all that process, and in order to carry out the wishes of the democratic decision of the village. Well, I think the interests from the rest of the village remained, but, you know, they didn't want to do anything about it. Mm-hmm. And so we kept them informed. They wanted to be informed, but they didn't really want to do anything more about it other than just, you know.
Angela, you should say that it was yourself and Isabel, two people.
Well, I'm about
two people that did this.
I'm about to say that, you know, the initial support was there. It was maintained, but people have busy lives. They want to do something else, or something else interests them. And this was a 6-year battle, really, to do that.
Just like the buyout, is a 6-year battle.
And it's the same with the buyout. It takes time. Mm. And we got there in the end. Mm. It wasn't just down to us. Obviously, we followed the process as laid down by the Scottish Government for granting these things. And we managed to do that. But it did fall down to, you know, a handful of people. So that's that. And that we are experiencing the same thing with the buyout. And I think we had a lot of, well, it's a new thing, like you and Lincoln have said. People don't know a lot about it. As we were learning, we were trying to inform the village as well. And maybe, again, with anything that I think takes a long time to process, people move on,
right.
You know. And then you suddenly, when there are, as we experience, is that although we held meetings about the buyout and we put out flyers and minutes up and all the rest of it, it wasn't until that people were faced with a vote, a final vote, that they paid attention.
I don't think that's fair, to be honest, because we, you know, if you look at our meetings and our consultation document, we had a lot of people come through those meetings.
Yes.
A lot of people got involved.
Yes, yes, yes. I'm not saying yes, but they didn't. But the final galvanization of people who never attended meetings.
That's more likely.
Or took the an people, in, or took an interest.
The people that
suddenly they found themselves having to vote on something that they either dismissed or did not take the trouble to engage with.
So it's in fact the people that didn't take part, that didn't come to meetings, that didn't know what it was about, that opposed it.
So one thing, just it's a little bit backwards here, but both of you have invested a tremendous amount of time and energy over the last decade and more, whether it's the buyout, the wind farm campaign, and so forth. Why does this place matter so much to you? Well, what makes Wanlock Head so special?
So we live here.
Well, that's
a trite answer, really. But it's true, isn't it? You know, you've got to be interested. You've got to be interested in the place you live. One of the reasons for moving from Sussex was we couldn't be interested in the place where we live. We couldn't take part in the place where we live because there's too many people. You couldn't get into the decision-making process very easily. That's one of the reasons for living in Scotland. You know, it's not, it's wanting to be part, wanting to be having some effect on your environment, having some effect on where you live.
And making new roots, you see. I mean, I've been uprooted several times. And, you know, that's a different story, but it's making roots.
But you guys obviously care about the community, as do I. We all moved here for various reasons. But you guys wouldn't have been involved if you hadn't cared. And it's a natural process, I think, in terms of people being involved and then disassociating themselves from whatever campaign they've been involved with. I'm just hoping there are other people who can come along and fill people. You know, leaders' shoes, and that is a challenge. Democracy is also inherently messy. It's a very messy process. We can blame the Greeks for that. You know.
Well, interestingly enough, because since you sent these questions, I've been thinking about that and talking about democracy, and I'm coming to the conclusion that, I mean, we, the village council, we bend over backwards to be really so democratic, because I mean it's something that I believe in, and it should be so that, especially in a small community, which is possible for people, for everyone to have a say. And we did consult with the village on many things, that ideas that the village came up with for the community, and we consulted and we said, you know, how about we do this and that and the other, please get in touch, let us know what you think, you know, because we wanted to see, engage with the community to see if there was a need and a desire for things that we were proposing as a village council. Well, I think most of the time we hardly got, you know, more than 10 or 15 people responding. And then really is then you're thinking, well, for a lot of things that might be good enough number, but then you think, well, you might just not do it because the people don't want it, you know, they don't want it. So therefore, you don't make any decisions. And I think maybe it could be because I wasn't really sure how things work, you know, that you don't have to consult on simply everything. You've been voted in and you make the decisions and you carry out what you think the people might want. And I'm just thinking along those lines now, that it's not possible to engage 100% with everybody, and you just have to, if you're in place, if you follow procedure and there's enough people to do the job that you're being voted for, you should just get on and do it, really.
So, but in some ways, things have not, in terms of land use and the decisions regarding land use around here, things really haven't changed that much in some ways since mining days, have they? Because the main landowner here calls the shots.
Yeah.
Now, it sounds like since Wanlakhead's inception, there's always been a core group of villagers who have helped the decision-making process move along in terms mm-hmm. of the day-to-day running of the village.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And also in terms of some of the bigger policy stuff, like the wind farm park, which was opposed. But in some ways, are we still living in a feudal system here where a landlord is a landlord like Buccleuch?
Some people are.
Yeah.
But also, I think if the miners were here, I don't think we'd have this problem. Because if you look at mining communities, they're far more active, they're far more engaged than other types of communities.
Right.
It's a tradition.
It is.
You know, it's about self-education. I see the buyouts following directly in line with the library.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at that, that was 18 people signed that and got that going. 18 miners. And they did it themselves, they got it going themselves. They obviously had encouragement before that when the Quakers were here, who'd obviously introduced them to education and all the rest of it. But then, the miners' library opens when the Quakers leave. And it's clear to me that they must have thought, well, we need to fill the gap in this education. And so they started this library. What an amazing achievement. It's not appreciated fully as to what it is, you know. So for me, this is the most important building in this village, really.
It was also, wasn't it also seen as a way out for their children, so they didn't have to go down the pit?
Yeah.
That's why they were keen on education.
It's interesting, though, today, though, the main landowner here is supportive of the buyout.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and now, that's what's in now.
Now.
And
not when we started.
True. But now, the landowner is supportive of the concept of the buyout, or they wouldn't have been in negotiations with us for so many years. However, what's interesting right now is where we go from here. And I guess the question is, how, in terms of the land buyout, how do we, A, involve the entire community, and B, how do we bring them along with the buyout? Because I think the buyout's going to occur.
Yeah.
And so I guess the question is then, you know, in terms of the decision-making process, does it need to change? How do we bring folks along if they don't want to be brought along? I'm asking a lot of questions here.
Right. If people don't want to be brought along, they won't be brought along.
Right.
We're not going to get... I keep saying this to people. I shouldn't have to say this. We're not going to get unanimous decisions here.
Yes.
Nobody ever does anywhere.
Yeah.
Right? You know, if you know, we have a government elected in the UK, usually on less than 40% of the vote, right? That means that 60% are voted against. And that's how our democracy works in the UK. But what you've got wherever you go, ever you go, is a division. We've got a division here, right? What we have to do, but the point is, In a democratic system, we have a majority. So we've got a mandate to carry on. We know that.
So if the buyout is successful, and so we have a community vote in favor of it, if we get funding for it and we purchase the land in the next year, then how are decisions going to be made for the land?
Right. The same as now, there'll be a board. And the board will employ professionals to do this work. Once it becomes a reality, and you look at other buyouts, more people will get involved because it's a reality.
Mm.
You know, if you talk to Agnes Rennie, who's from the Galton Estate on the Isle of Lewis, which is one of the biggest buyouts in Scotland, they are now often treated as if they are the local government people go to them first.
Interesting.
And that's what will happen here. If we are successful, you will find that people will come to us. It's not unusual to have a local council that's an opposition. This happens on the Isle of Barrow. This happens in Gorson, I've just mentioned. That often the local community council comprised of individuals that are quite opposed to what's going on in the buyout.
So it sounds like overall we just need to accept the fact that democracy is messy and we need to keep fighting for our right to a democratic system when
We have to remember that we had a perfectly democratic vote, which we went out of our way to make sure was such. We allowed people, most of those postal votes, as they're called, were from the antis. We enabled them, if they weren't even in the village, to place their no votes. You can't get much more democratic than that.
True.
They wouldn't have been, a lot of them wouldn't have been able to vote in a normal election. We encouraged to have it as fair as possible, and we got a majority, and we need to remember that. And that's our mandate to do what we're doing.
Do you think once the buyout is a reality that people will step up to the plate in terms of making decisions and being a part of the process?
Yeah.
Well, it would seem from other buyouts that that's the case. And if you look in our village, there are people who have abilities, you know, to step forward and take part.
Mm.
Because like Lincoln says, you know, there's a new reality, you know, that and we have to remember, like you say, the valid points that you said, Mark, is that there is a residue of feudalism, and people in the psyche or in the genes of this is a small place owned by a vast estate, and the residue of how that used to work, mm-hmm. Still persists with those who have doubts and probably think, well, and also the fact that they think, oh my God, this belongs to an estate. They've got the means and the wherewithal to deal with whatever it needs to be done. What do we have to do? You know, they don't want to be worried about maintenance or anything like that. And, you know, it's fear first, panic, without really getting proper information or bothering to. That's a factor. I'm thinking about, we all think about going forward, is that a new message up the game. You know, it'd be great if we could get a PR advice, because it's all about although we've been messaging, it's just we need to do more of that, you know, and maybe how we change it to engage, even if people are to read it and go piff, and read it and say, oh yes, you know, galvanized again, you know, but because we mustn't forget, like you say, Lincoln, the majority that voted for this, and they remain silent because they don't want to be part of.
We don't have time to rerun it. We have the time to inform people,
inform,
and engage people, and to get their input. That's what we need.
Well, yes,
we need their input.
As, I'm not saying to start it again. That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
I have to say that, the messiness aside, I am, despite myself, an optimist regarding the future of the land here, mm-hmm. in terms of the community making decisions for itself. Mm-hmm. I think we have a fairly optimistic future when it comes down to it. If we can get the buyout accomplished, we can do so much. Last question is, what would you change about how decisions are made here locally, whether it's the village or the land? It sounds like we're kind of in agreement that it's a messy democratic process, but it needs to continue, and we need to involve everyone.
Well, if you look at what is the buyout about, what is it about? It is about community engagement.
Mm.
It's about sustainable communities, and it's about getting people involved.
Mm.
You know, Britain is not a country where the average bod gets involved. It isn't. We've got a long history of whether it's kings or dukes or earls or, you know, we've got the whole gamut here. We've still got a House of Lords that's completely unelected, making major decisions. That's how Britain has worked. If you talk to a Frenchman or a German or a Dutchman, you know, they find this pretty undemocratic country compared to theirs, you know, compared to America. It's old-fashioned in many ways. It's coming round slowly, very slowly, it's coming round. And this is part of the process. And Scotland is ahead of where England is, because this doesn't go on in England. You know, they have different kinds of things, but they don't have community buyouts. They don't have communities running their own affairs. So this is kind of pioneering stuff, really. And the British aren't used to it. The Scots aren't used to it. But the difference is the Western Highlands and the Highlands in general, they've got the folk memory of the clearances. They know how it works if you don't control your land. They know what can happen to you. So that folk memory is a driving force. Now, it happened down here, but there isn't a folk memory of it.
I know, that's interesting, because there were the lowland clearances as well, but yeah. they're not as etched in, as you say, in the public psyche.
No.
And the Highland clearances made that the case. No, you're right. You're right. South of Scotland has a series of challenges, but especially wrestling with its own psyche. And,
yeah, we've done okay. I mean, and don't forget Langham, which is actually now a buyout, a successful buyout. Mm. It's proceeding on its way.
Mm. How would you like to change the how decisions are made in terms of the village and the land?
Well, I would like the buyout to succeed. I would like people to get involved. And I would like people to start realizing that they are part of this process and they need to take part.
Absolutely. Either make the decisions or they'll be made for you.
That's right.
Indeed. Well, here's to the future, guys. Mm-hmm. Let's have some more coffee.
Thank you.
I'm Annie Tindley, a historian of land issues at Newcastle University. And on behalf of the network, we hope you enjoyed this conversation and be sure to tune into the rest of the series. If you'd like to find out a bit more on the participants, the podcast series and the network of community groups, organisations, policymakers and researchers that has set it up, please visit www.landdecisions.org. Our aim is to influence future thinking on cultures of decision making. That is, how decisions about the land are made in practice so that people are better able to take part in decisions that affect them. Our work is therefore directed towards politicians and policymakers, government and public bodies, but most importantly, communities of place and interest who have already acquired land or are planning to do so in the future. Please join us again soon.